My beloved brothers and sisters, I pray that I may be guided.
Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here, there can be no denying. One of us is changing, or maybe we just stopped trying.
Beloved brothers and sisters.
Baby, come back. You can blame it all on me. I was wrong, and I just can't live without you.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today we will have another listener essay for you. We will be pleased to hear from Sister Jill Searle. After Sister Searle's remarks, we will be pleased to hear the special musical number, and we will close with a panel discussion involving myself, Brother Jake Frost, Sister Erica Schertz, Brother Scott Rowley, and Brother Matt Long. Sister Searle.
My lucky day. When asked why I left the Mormon Church, I often don't have a fast and easy answer. There was no single reason I left. There was a lifetime of experiences, a lot of personal study, a lot of truth seeking. Then one day I found that my questions were bigger than the answers. I found my time in church on Sunday was no longer uplifting. It had become a place where I was drained of every ounce of my strength. My leaving didn't happen overnight. It happened over years. There were some last straws that broke the proverbial camel's back, and there were definitely some defining moments that made leaving easier. The following experience is one of those defining moments. Not a reason for my leaving, as much as a clarifying moment when I thought, why the hell should I stay? My last trip to the temple turned out to be a pretty good finale to my Mormon life. First, the story leading up to the event. As your stake president, I don't feel I can sign your recommend today. It's clear that you don't sustain the leaders and you don't believe in the main tenets of the gospel. What I'm trying to tell you, President Marshall, is that though I respect and sustain the church leadership, I would just like to see the church take a stronger stance on domestic violence. I know of individuals in my own ward who deal with spousal abuse and child abuse in their homes, and they are getting no support from the church. The door to the office shut behind me, and it hit me that for the first time in my life, I was being denied the approval I needed to enter the temple to practice one of the most important principles of my religion. How can one man have this kind of control over my life? As I thought about my conversation with President Marshall about the problems of domestic violence in the church, I recalled a conversation with my friend Karen I had had 3 months previous. Wow, Karen, has anyone else read your journals? I had no idea you and the kids were going through this. Why don't you leave? Craig will find me, Karen tells me, her hands visibly shaking. He said if I leave, he will find me and the kids and we'll pay for it. I'm pregnant again, and I do not want to put another child in this situation. My therapist at LDS Social Services has read my journals and has heard everything. He thinks I should stay and make it work, but it's not going to work. I can't believe anyone at LDS Social Services would read this and tell you to stay. Your therapist must be a crazy person. Going to leave as soon as the baby's born. It will be summer, the kids will be out of school, my job will be changing too, and I can transfer to another city. You need to involve the police. This is serious bad stuff, Karen. I don't know if you're safe waiting it out. I think I'll be okay. Craig's working nights and is only home. We're all away. I don't want to call the police until the kids and I are safe. 2 weeks after my initial interview with the stake president, I tried again. And every 2 weeks for the next 6 months, each interview proving to be more frustrating than the previous one. For some reason, President Marshall has an issue with me and somehow believes I'm not worthy because, as he sees it, I don't sustain the leaders. Who is the head of your household, sister? President Marshall asks during one of our many interviews. Is your husband at the head of your household? My reply was evidently not what he wanted to hear. Both my husband and I are the head of our household. It's important to both of us that we lead together and our children see us as equals. I paused. Then I asked, President Marshall, did you receive a letter from Elder Marion D. Hanks on my behalf? I knew he had because I had written Elder Hanks a few weeks previous explaining the situation and asking him if he thought that what the stake president was basing his decision on was a legitimate issue. I had received a copy of the letter Elder Hanks had written to the stake president, urging him to reconsider his stance. Elder Hanks wrote, I know Sister Cyrille, and I know her heart. I vouch for her worthiness and her honest desire to go to the temple. President Marshall folded his hands on the desk in front of him. I did receive his letter, and my decision stays the same. It's obvious to me you have a problem with patriarchy, and if you don't honor the priesthood, you are not sustaining our leaders, and you are not worthy of a temple recommend. I was astonished. I can't believe, President, that because I'm speaking up for women and children who are being abused and violated, that you are concluding I'm unworthy. We have been meeting for 6 months, and I still have no recommend. What do I have to do in order to prove my worthiness and get your signature on this piece of paper? 3 months and four interviews later, I'm in the church foyer waiting to talk to President Marshall once again. I'm a little uncomfortable because Craig, the abusive husband of my friend Karen, is also waiting for an interview. I'm not sure if Craig knows of my friendship with his wife. I'm pretty sure he doesn't. Karen would be the last person to let on that anyone knew of the situation. Are you waiting to talk to President Marshall? Craig asks. Yes, you too, I suppose. Craig flashes his temple recommend. Yep, waiting to get my recommend signed. Just got the bishop's signature. I distract myself, hoping to end the conversation with this vile man. First of all, I can't believe with what the bishop knows about Craig that he would sign his recommend. Karen has met with the bishop as well as her therapist many times seeking advice, only to be told to do what it takes to make her marriage work. Why do I even care, I think to myself. This experience has been horrible. I can't believe these men are inspired. Well, maybe President Marshall will withhold Craig's recommend. I can't imagine he would sign his recommend, seeing how he has given me such a difficult time. It doesn't take inspiration to figure out that Craig is a total douchebag. The door to the stake president's office opens, and Craig walks in, and, no kidding, 20 minutes later walks out with a signed recommend. Must be my lucky day, Craig says as he gives me a look that somehow tells me he knows of my friendship with his wife. My stomach wrenches and I have to look away. The irony of the situation is baffling to me. Here I am, for close to a year now, trying to get my recommend signed. And the reason I can't get it signed just walked out of the president's office with a little slip of paper stating his worthiness is greater than mine in the eyes of President Marshall. Ergo the church. Ergo God. My thoughts are racing. President Marshall obviously doesn't know Craig. Craig must have lied, saying whatever it took to get his recommend signed. They aren't difficult questions after all. Yes, 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 no, yes. The answers are simple enough. I walked into the president's office and I see the man who I've been contending with for the last several months in a strange new light. For the first time, I notice the framed license on his wall, stating that he is a licensed therapist working for LDS Social Services. This is too coincidental, I think. I'll have to ask Karen who her therapist is. You know Brother President Marshall asks. Yes, he's in my ward. I'm good friends with his wife, Karen. We know each other quite well. My reply seems to strike a chord with him, and for some unexplained reason, I leave his office that day with my recommend signed. Must be my lucky day. The recommend in my hand didn't seem like a gift or a prize. It seemed like a worthless slip of paper. I wanted to wad it up and throw it into the trash. So much had happened over the last year. Karen had a baby boy and was still planning her escape from an abusive marriage. I had made my own self-discoveries and was dealing with the idea of being gay, yet still remaining in my marriage and the church. I laughed as I thought about what President Marshall might think if he knew that story. By this time, I had figured out that these men who had jurisdiction over my worthiness didn't need to know everything about me. Besides, it's not a sin to be gay, only to act gay. At least now I can go to the temple with Linda. Linda had been telling me how she wanted me to go with her because she was doing work for her ancestors. I guess I could muster the spirituality to go with Linda this week. Ward Temple Day was on Saturday. I left the president's office and headed down the hallway to attend Relief Society meeting. I sat down next to Karen. Karen, who's your therapist at LDS Social Services? It didn't surprise me when she told me that it was President Marshall. I didn't hear a word of the lesson that day, something about charity or some such thing. Linda and I met up on Saturday morning and headed up to the temple. My heart wasn't completely in it, but I knew it was important to Linda, and I thought I could dig down deep and create a spiritual experience. We arrived at the temple and eventually made our way to the room where we would be for the next hour or so to participate in what is considered by believing Mormons a sacred ritual. Fast forward to the end of the session, where they asked for people to go to the front of the room and stand in a circle for a prayer. Linda, myself, and several others walked up to the front and stood at the altar. In way of explanation, for those of you not familiar with the ceremony, there needs to be an equal number of men and women in the circle. So when there is a man or a woman by themselves without a person of the opposite sex with them, they will call someone up from the group to balance the numbers. Male, female, around in a circle, the man to the right and the woman to the left, in couples. On this occasion, I'm without a male partner. The man conducting the session asked for a male volunteer to stand with me in the prayer circle. Now, you may think I'm making this next bit up, but I'm not. This really happened. I'm standing there waiting for someone to come stand with me in the prayer circle, and up walks, wait for it. Yes, you're right. Up walks Craig. What are the chances? I guess it was my lucky day. Up to this point, I hadn't noticed him, but now here I am, standing next to him in the prayer circle. I hear the officiator say, "If any of you have unkind feelings about anyone in the circle, we ask that you withdraw." What do I do? I do not like this man. I have very unkind feelings towards him. Oh well, pretend, just like you've been doing all your life. After a few more words, we are asked to take the hand of the person next to us in a symbolic grip called the patriarchal grip. Ironic, right? I wanted to leave the circle. I wanted to stand up for Karen and all the women like her and somehow call Craig out for all of the physical and sexual abuse he had perpetrated on his family. But I didn't. I stood there with Craig to my right, holding my hand in the patriarchal grip. I'm not sure if he was aware that I knew what kind of a man he was, but somehow I think he did know. And this was his way of being in control and having a bit of power over me. If I did sit down, he would know for sure that Karen had told me things, and this might put her in danger. So I suppose pretending was the best thing to do. The prayer circle finished up, and we proceeded to the next part of the temple session. Eventually, Linda and I are in the celestial room. We're on a more typical day. I might have felt calm and peace. But now I'm feeling very uncomfortable, and all I want to do is run from this room screaming. I quickly exit and return to the safest place in the temple, the ladies' locker room. I guess it was my lucky day.
Special musical number.
My beloved brothers and sisters, I pray that I may be guided.
Baby, come back.
Any kind of fool could truly see there was something in everything about you.
Baby, come back. you could blame it all on me.
I was wrong.
Okay, well, let's just go ahead and start in with this. So thank you for writing the essay. What made you want to write it and share this story with us?
Well, it's something that I had already written when I started blogging. It was just one of those experiences I had to get down on paper.
Yeah.
Because whenever I retold it, no one quite believed it. So I just kind of wanted to get it written down. And it was one of my blog posts a while ago.
And where do you blog?
It's at a blog spot on Blogger called Thoughts Per Coffee. And that came from the fact that every time I have a cup of coffee in my hand, I bore my family to tears with all my philosophizing and my solving of world problems. Something about having a cup of coffee.
Uh-huh. It turns you into an expert on all things,
on
everything.
Yeah, on right. All things.
Well, tell us a little bit about your background, your family, and history in the church, and just let us get to know you a little bit.
Well, you know, I took that little test that you had on to see just how legitimate of an ex-Mormon I was, and I think I scored pretty high.
Bob's Mormon cred?
Yeah, my ex-Mormon cred.
Yeah, we need to lead now from now on, like asking people what your Mormon cred score is. Or something.
Well, yeah, hold on. It's not ex-Mormon cred. It's what your Mormon cred is. Yeah.
Oh, my Mormon cred. Well,
yeah,
my Mormon cred is pretty high up there. Five generations Mormon on both sides of my family. My ancestors came across the plains in the Willie Martin Handcart Company. And then I was married in the temple. Well, first of all, I went to BYU. Mm. Then I went on a mission to Taiwan and Thailand. Returned from my mission and was married in the Salt Lake Temple by Marion D. Hanks.
Taiwan and Thailand?
Yeah, I was in Taiwan for a year and a half proselyting, and then I was transferred to Thailand to work in the refugee camp.
Wow.
They just thought they sounded similar, so...
Yeah, right.
You know, they're all the same. You know.
One of those tea countries in Asia.
Yeah, the Taiwa something, yeah.
So that's kind of how I hooked up with Elder Marion D. Hanks, because he was the general authority that started the refugee camp project and missionaries working in the refugee camp.
Yeah, and he was my dad's mission president in London, yeah, in the early 60s.
He's one of the good guys, I think.
Yeah. So did you have stinky tofu in Taiwan?
Oh, yeah.
Did you like it? I could never bring myself to try it.
I never did like it, but, you know, they used to sell it from these little carts that played music, kind of like the ice cream truck. So, yeah, you'd think it was good, but no.
Did you ever go into one of those, like, snake shops where they slit the snake open and they drink the blood and they put it in a cup? Did you do that?
We did. That was kind of a missionary initiation experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was weird. You could feel this presence of Satan there.
I'm sure. There's all these snakes around. Okay, so you did a mission, married in the temple, and...
had three children.
Lived happily ever after, right?
Lived almost happily ever after. Well, I'm living happily ever after,
right.
Just not that life I thought I would live.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm doing great right now. After 10 years of marriage and three children, I was married to a really great guy. So even though... He's my ex. We're still good friends. He's been a good father to my kids and a good ex-husband.
Yeah.
And very supportive of me and my relationship with my partner, Susie.
Yeah.
But very, very conservative. Comes from a very conservative family. His mom is related to John Birch. That's how conservative.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they did not approve of my lifestyle choices, but... they've kind of come around after my ex found the love of his life, and they were able to build back their temple home and their eternal family unit.
Yeah. So you said you were married for 10 years and then you divorced.
Right.
So
yes.
did you come out at that time, or were you still in the closet during that
time?
Well,
yeah.
And like,
what
era are we talking about?
We're back in the 90s, 1996.
All right.
My oldest was 6 years old and my youngest was two. And, I read a book. It was called Peculiar People. And it was I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a book that was an LDS book, but it was written about, gay people from the perspective of the gay person and the perspective of the spouse and the perspective of psychologists. And so it was kind of a really interesting book. And I read it, and because a friend of ours who was gay gave it to us, and he wanted us to understand him.
Uh-huh.
So when I read it, though, man, I was highlighting all the parts, every little lesbian sentence that came up. I was like, oh, my God, this is so me. I was highlighting it and reading through it, and then I gave it to my husband to read, and he's like, so what's with all the highlights and the notes and the margins here? So, yeah, it was... There's a whole comical series of red flags during our engagement and our early years of marriage and all through our marriage that should have been big indicators, but I was quite naive.
So would you say that that was kind of, it sounds like that was almost like that was when you realized your orientation. Was that, what was the process like for you to, you know, finding that out? Is that, did it happen gradually, or was that something that you'd known about years before, or I'm just curious.
I don't know if it makes sense, but it was one of those things that dawned on me when I was 36, but once it dawned on me, it made my whole life make sense, so it's like I knew it all my life. Mm-hmm. And finally gave myself permission to accept all these bits and pieces of my history and all these bits and pieces of myself and kind of put it all together. So it even when I was at BYU and totally in love with my roommate, I didn't know what was going on. I just figured we were kindred spirits and
that it was like a good friendship. Yeah. So like what was the process like of giving yourself permission? Because I would think that being in the church, your natural instinct would be to, you know, put it in a box and crush it, you know, tiny boxes.
Yeah. When I was at BYU, I went to one of the BYU therapists, and I was the first time I said, I think I might be gay.
Oh, really?
And the therapist just said, no, you just don't like men because of all these horrible experiences you've had with men. Mm. And so I said, okay. So thank God I was able to minimize that dissonance so that I could continue my faithful life in the Mormon church. So I just put it back on a shelf and said, I'm not gay. I just don't like men.
Yeah. Hey, what do you know? Look at that. A lesbian sighting. My lucky day. They're so fascinating. Why is that? Because they don't want us. You got to respect that.
So whatever that meant, but it satisfied me for quite a few years. And when I was engaged to my ex-husband, when we were engaged, I had a lot of really difficult times. I became suicidal at one point, but he just kind of sensed something was going on, and he stayed with me really late into the night until it kind of passed, and then I was fine. So I gave him my engagement ring back two or three times, and I just always ended up with it back on my ring. But all these reasons were anything but being gay. They were reasons like, well, I was abused when I was young, and so this is causing me all kinds of problems, and we'll work through them, and as long as we're faithful, all will be well. And I can't be gay because I'm a good person, and good people who are doing the right thing aren't gay. And you have to remember, this is back in the 80s.
Yeah.
So, and in Utah.
Yeah.
And at BYU. So,
wow.
Didn't know a whole lot about the being gay. Gay, you know, awareness of homosexuality is so much more these days than it was then. When I was in high school, the only thing I knew about gays is that they wore green on Thursday. Since I didn't wear green on Thursday, I was okay.
Yeah. Wow. That's funny.
Did they do that at your school? Was that like a gay club?
Yeah,
thing?
That was like a thing, yeah.
Wow.
Or if you ate green M&Ms. I don't know why green.
I thought that just meant you were...
You were horny.
Yeah, right.
Well, you were horny.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. But maybe in my high school, it was different. Who knows?
Yeah. All right, where do you guys want to take it?
I wanted to address what was in the essay as well. So one of the things that stuck out to me the most was your experience with the church leaders basically ignoring domestic violence and doing nothing about it from an ecclesiastical perspective. I've experienced the same thing. I'm an attorney and I do mostly divorce work. I also do some criminal defense work, and I've seen a lot of cases with domestic violence, and I haven't seen a single case where a parent who's committed an act of domestic violence has gotten in trouble with their ecclesiastical LDS, with their bishop or anyone.
Right.
I mean, it just doesn't happen, and I can't believe it doesn't happen. And your essay just resonated with me so much. I wanted to comment on that, and I wondered if anybody else had any thoughts on that.
Well, what do you mean, Scott, when you say get in trouble? Like, what are the things that you would expect to see happen that aren't happening?
Yeah, sure. So let's say let's break it down a little bit. Husband and wife, married in the church, married in the temple, and they, let's say the husband has an affair, right? He's going to have some disciplinary action against him, at least something informal, when the bishop finds out. He's going to get either disfellowshipped, or he's not going to be able to take the sacrament, or he could be excommunicated. It depends, but they're going to do something about it. Mm-hmm. It's not just going to be nothing. If he steals money from his company and it gets caught, same kind of thing's going to happen. So the church has a handbook that sets forth, hey, these kinds of offenses, this is the level of what should happen. It's all laid out there in the church's handbook. And for the most part, I think the leaders stick to that fairly well. But what I've seen is, let's say that the couple is going through a divorce, or they're arguing and things get physical. The husband pushes the wife, stereotypical case, and gets charged with a misdemeanor, assault or disorderly conduct. Police come out, arrest him. He goes to jail. He gets a slap on the wrist in court and, moves on with his life, and they get divorced or whatever happens. Well, there's nothing ever happens church-wise for that guy. He gets remarried, to somebody else a year later in the temple, and there's no follow-up with it whatsoever. Or he's, baptizing their son the next month, and there's no follow-up with it.
Is that not addressed at all in the bishop's handbook?
It's addressed in there, but my point is that there's, on a practical level, when these things come up, the bishops, more than anything, just want people to get along, and they try to dissuade people from getting divorced for as long as they possibly can. And more times than not, they're taking the husband's side of things and basically not looking at it from a perspective of, hey, maybe this guy's got a problem.
Well, I think there's not, to answer your question, Glenn, there's not specific direction on what some people think of as minor domestic violence, which is silly to say, but the pushing, the breaking things, these are forms of domestic violence that are often overlooked as, well, he had a bad day, well, he was just angry in the moment, and these are things I think are what the bishop, ecclesiastical leaders are really quick to overlook and not recognize. This is really a cycle of violence that's going on in the home. So that's the problem, is the lack of, again, I come back to lack of training, lack of experience, lack of understanding of some really complex issues. In this case, the cycles of violence that go on in domestic relationships.
But this doesn't seem to be the case in Jill's circumstance, because her state president should be a licensed counselor, right? He should have had training in what these experiences do to a person and what they do to a family, and how, a family safety should be more important than, oh, let's try to make this work. Like, it seems like the churches or people in administration of the church are more concerned with keeping a marriage together than keeping women and children safe. Like, that's more important.
Yeah, that was my experience. I hope that things have changed. I hope that things have gotten better. But in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it just that's what it was about. It was preserving right. that eternal family unit and putting up with that abusive husband or father and trying to do whatever you could do to not upset that person.
Yeah. I would hope it's changed, but I don't know. I haven't had that many experiences, you know, in the inside knowing whether it has or not.
No, I think just like anything, the church is still behind. I think things have changed in the world. Things have changed in a lot of places, but I think it's still pretty backwards in the church, unfortunately.
So what would this is a question that I would have because I think that if you asked any, you know, member of the church, they'd say, you know, we absolutely abhor domestic violence and we're very against that. So, I mean, I think, you know, in word they're against that, but where exactly is it not where's the gap in terms of actually implementing it? So, you know, things like what Jill experienced wouldn't happen. What would a more ideal like stance on that type of thing look like?
Well, one big gap that I've noticed is that it stops at the bishop or it stops at the stake president. Like, for example, when I was young and I was molested by a member of the ward and went to the bishop, told him who it was, and the bishop did a really good job of telling me it wasn't my fault. But the bishop did nothing else. The bishop didn't report the incident to the police. It didn't become a legal matter. It stayed an ecclesiastical matter, and bishops and stake presidents never followed through, and they never encouraged. And I, as a young girl at that point, I was 15, didn't think I needed to go any further than to my bishop. So I think that's a big problem. I don't know if it still is. I don't know if they're required to report these things now or not, but they weren't.
Well, there's different, Matt could probably speak to this better than I could. There's different standards of whether or not, different rules for whether or not they have to report something. Generally, if it's told to them in a confessional situation, they don't have a duty to report. But there's other times where they do have a duty to report to the authorities. But what gets me isn't so much the duty to report. It's that, like in your situation, where I mean, the duty to report obviously is a big deal. But what I was commenting on more so was when the church leaders can say, or they do say that, okay, having something like an affair you're more culpable for that morally, and you're going to be disciplined more for that than you will be, say, if you, you know, push your spouse to the ground. Situation where it's, you know, physical violence, and there's absolutely nothing that happens. And I'll say too, this happens. It's so common. I mean, people can't even. I live here in a pretty heavily populated Mormon area, and it's got to be every single ward where there's issues with this. There's people in the ward who have had domestic violence charges against them, and there's nothing that happens about it. Nobody's notified. You know, they're still in the young men's program, or they're still involved with kids in the ward, and it's just mind blowing that it's not taken more seriously.
Well, it's not even in the top 10, you know, the 10 commandments that God gave Moses.
Right.
It wasn't yeah. there, and it's certainly not in the LDS top 3 with
no
murder and, you know, just consensual sex and denying the Holy Ghost, you know, apostasy, which right. is just I think that speaks more to just a general what is it?
Like a cultural zeitgeist that we haven't really realized
ever,
how serious
ever.
Right.
Like it's just always been this hidden underneath the surface. Not that it wasn't common, but just the unspeakable abuse that goes on in families. And maybe in other cultures it was more accepted because people were treated like property instead of being treated like equals. But it's odd that it hasn't surfaced, cracked the 10 or cracked the 3.
Yeah, and my response to... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, why is that? Is that because it's so common that it's like, well, it's not going to, I don't, it's, or is it just because it's a patriarchal society and it's usually men who are, you know, doing the abusing? Like, why is that? Because it's clearly, like, no one is for abuse. Like, no one is. So why is it not as serious as having consensual sex?
Right.
I think a lot of people look at it as, hey, that's what's going on in their home, and we're gonna keep our nose out of their business. I think there's still a lot of that attitude.
Has that ever been an attitude for a bishop, to keep their nose out of someone else's business?
Yeah, that's their whole job, isn't it? Being other people's business.
Well, we're laughing, but it's stewardship, right? They've got stewardship for everybody in the ward.
Right, like that's what they're supposed to do. Yeah. So, like, why that reason doesn't fly either. So why is it?
I think it is. It does go to patriarchy, and it's the same reason why prostitution in most states carries really, really minor penalties. Is because politicians like their prostitutes, right. and it's the same that when you
so
have
do podcasters.
when you have a bishop who. Or let's say a man who does get short with their family. They're a little more tolerant. They're a little more accepting. I think they can see, yeah, me too. I could see how that would happen. I could see how I could grab my kid and leave a red mark and do some of these things that these guys, especially when it comes to domestic violence, are coming in and disclosing and confessing to. So I think it's easy for them to be somewhat dismissive because they don't see that as being – really outside the norm of behavior that they not only experience but could certainly contemplate. So it's a naivety. It's a shared experience, but it's also a naivety of, but this is a good guy, not realizing right. that good guys can do really, really bad things, Matt, on a regular basis. So it's the assuming the best in people as well, and so that's why I don't think it's. I think that's why those types of things are overlooked,
Matt.
This is more so than
Matt. You're turning into a robot.
I'll be back.
Anyway, I think a big part of it is that it's just not on the list. It's not on those list of things that are talked about very often. I mean, I think it's something that needs to be brought up over and over again, and it's something that people need to be educated on, and there's no excuse for having bishops who are counseling people where this is going on who haven't had professional training and counseling on how to deal with this.
I think you're totally right.
Erica?
Did we lose Erica?
Oh, that was weird.
It stopped where you said I was totally right, which is always a good place to stop. But
I guess it's time for the closing prayer, right? Yeah. I think you're right that the more we talk about it, I think this is a circumstance where the church. I have hopes that the church will change. Like, I think that they can. I think this is something that most people agree with. Most ecclesiastical leaders agree with. And that this can be changed in the church, and that there can be more awareness and more understanding of it.
Don't you think they're just protecting themselves and their image?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm sure that's part of it, but go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, I'm sure that's part of it, and I'm sure there will always be, you know, leaders that want to protect themselves and want to be controlling and want to be, you know, just don't understand the seriousness of it. But I think there are leaders that the more that it's talked about will make a change about it. I think this is an issue that there could be change.
Okay. Well, I mean, and I agree with that, but the thing is, like, this is a softball. Like, yeah, how did you miss this? Like, we're talking now about, given these more modern sensibilities that we have now in, you know, 2014, maybe the church can evolve. But the thing, how is this not something on your list from day one? I mean, this is a no-brainer. Like, it's one of those examples where it's painfully clear that the moral priorities of the church are just totally fucked up. Because
exactly.
How is this not right up at the, why, how's this not in the top three, like Glenn was saying?
It's never been in any culture. Yeah. Like it's
the historical problem that's been pervasive across probably every society, and right. and yet it's not something that's dealt with. I think a big problem with this as well is the way that the wards are structured. You know, so you think about a husband who's been in a ward for a while. He might be friends with the bishop. He might be a young men's leader, or he might be in the bishopric himself, or he might be, you know, in a stake calling or something like that. So how much is it going to complicate the bishop's life if the bishop has some discretion on whether or not to do anything about this? Is he going to have the motivation to push forward with it if it's going to cause a bigger problem within the ward? It's going to be a bigger headache for him to deal with it than it is to just ignore it.
That's so cynical.
Well, let me tell you my story. Okay. So I was in a ward in Ohio where there was a convicted sex offender who was a member of the ward, which I was in the ward for years and didn't know that. Okay. And there was an issue that came up with a family in the ward and this person who was in the ward, and it wasn't that there was an abuse that happened, but this person was talking with other people in a very public and a very suggestive way about certain kids that were in the ward. And this was all, it was online. It was being, this person in the ward was discussing particular children in the ward in a sexual way with other people online. So pretty messed up. And this person's already a convicted sex offender and
He was probably called to serve in the primary.
No, he wasn't in the primary, and the bishop knew about it. But when this happened, the bishop brought it up in a fifth Sunday kind of Sunday school hour or combined Relief Society priesthood hour kind of thing, brings it up and just immediately dismissed it as, hey, we've got this taken care of. There's no issue here. And there were some accusations against this guy, and there's nothing, nobody's been abused, and we've got it all under control. Didn't tell any of the members about the fact that this was online. And he was real vague and cagey about it. So I talked to him about it after the fact and got enough more information about it that I was able to look it up online, figure out who the member was, and then backtrack it from there and figure out what he posted online. The bishop didn't tell any of the details with it. He wanted to do just enough to cover his ass if there was a problem, but didn't want to give anybody else anything that would be useful in any way. I mean, I had a kid in the ward at this point, and he didn't even say, you know, who this person was or what they had done or anything about it. So I was really frustrated with that way. So when you say that's a really cynical way of looking at it, I guess that's how I look at it, because I've seen that as a ward member on my own, and that was with sexual abuse. But
so let me ask this, because ever since I mentioned the Ten Commandments in the top three, I've been trying to remember. I think there's a scripture in the New Testament, so I've been looking this up. There's one in Luke 17:2, Matthew 18:6, that talks about little children, and that if anyone offends one of these, it'd be better that what does that say?
Millstone.
Yeah. Millstone were hanged about his neck, and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. So is that referring to sexual abuse, like sexually abusing little children? And this is kind of the roundabout way that it's being brought up as, a no-no?
I would think so.
I think you could interpret it that way. The problem with that is that that's talking about God's judgment. That's not talking about, you know, what we should be doing with it.
And it was just, I mean, it's clear that it was never really internalized. I mean, it was never institutionalized the way that, you know, no adultery was or whatever. I mean, that's painfully obvious because of the way that, you know, the pervasiveness of it being swept under the rug much more than these other types of, like, sexual type sins.
Well, Glenn, are you trying to play devil's advocate here and say, hey, maybe the church really does teach against this or something?
Not the church, but like if we go back to the cultural zeitgeist question, and you know, if we're saying that abuse within the family, and that's a pretty broad term, but abuse within the family has been around for a while, so why hasn't it cracked the top 10? Or you know, maybe it was around, but it was so cryptic that it wasn't institutionalized more, like Jake said.
Yeah, well, maybe another one would be throw it into, you know, Jill's story talked about the temple recommends.
Yeah,
pretty intensely.
Right.
How much effort would it be for them to put in a question there about?
Well, there is, you know, there is one about family relationships. It's again pretty cryptic, but they ask, is there any relationship that's out of harmony? Some question like that. Did that come up in your case, Jill?
No, well, it didn't for me. And, of course, I wasn't part of this guy's interview with the bishop or the stake president. So how his recommend was signed, I have no idea, since the stake president knew everything about what was happening in his home. To me, I don't understand it. Let me ask you, men, because men, by nature, you're protectors, you're warriors, you're defenders of your families, of women, of children. So how does a bishop or a stake president go against his nature like that? Is it like Matt said? I think it was Matt that said it's some sort of backwards empathy that they have for this man because, oh, he's tired, he worked hard. I could see how he smacked his wife across the room.
Well,
I did that myself.
What was the situation again, Jill? It was the stake president was the therapist.
He worked with LDS Social Services, yeah. Yeah, he had read her journals. He knew everything that she had said to him.
Had he been working with the husband as like because all that I could imagine in response to your question is that if the husband was going to him and putting on this very penitent face and saying, oh, I feel so horrible about this and I'm really working on it and I'm kneeling and I'm praying to the Lord, that the stake president would be kind of flattered by that and placated and like, okay, all right, he's working on it. I don't want to be the one that keeps him from connecting to celestial power, you know, or whatever that can help him in his life.
Maybe
this will help
him.
Or he just doesn't believe her, or doesn't believe that the problem is as serious as it possibly was. I mean, that's the other thing.
Maybe he thinks she's hysterical.
No, there's two sides to all of these.
Hysterical.
Yeah.
And the way you described him, he seems to be a narcissist. I think your description of him coming up to send you a message in the temple, that's how I read it exactly before you said that. Is him? That's just typical.
You're talking about the abusive husband.
Yeah, the husband, the Craig guy, typical power control techniques that you'd see someone that I would consider in a domestic violence relationship would try to use. But I could see the state president not believing completely your friend, or the penitence. I think or the repentance part of it. They see that as so in having so much impact and being so significant when somebody comes in and says, oh yeah, I'm working on this, and it's just like boom, yeah, let's move on. And the best thing for you would be to not make a big deal out of it, to not make it more difficult on you, to have access to the temple and all these things. And I really believe that's why they're so quick to provide salve for the offender in both sexual and physical abuse cases, and at the same time kind of minimize the trauma to the victim. Oh, you need to forgive is what comes up.
Right.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I never looked at it that way. It kind of, I never understood what the stake president was about and where he was coming from, but that's a real possibility.
Yeah, and especially if Craig is putting on a show. And coming to him with a broken heart and a contrite spirit, like my, I don't know if she'll want me to say this. Somebody who I know really close and gave birth to me had a second husband that was a drug addict, and he knew how to manipulate everybody in the ward. And they were only married for about 3 years, but he would put on you know, I'm the perdition, son of perdition returned, and you know, he would play into that narrative of I've gone through the repentance process, and now here you have the opportunity to welcome me back into the fold with open arms, and doesn't that make you all feel better about yourselves? That if that's playing off in some small way with the state president, I can see why he would let things go. But Scott, I pulled up the Temple Recommend question. So question number 6, is there anything in your conduct relating to members of your family that is not in harmony with the teachings of the church?
Yeah, but they're just going to say no.
Right.
And then go on.
Yeah.
So
no, I've repented.
Yeah. Or they're going to think that's not in harmony with the church, and then they're going to rationalize it like, well, the church tells me I'm the head of my household, and my dad was rough on me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And so, dang it, I can, you know, if I need to get what needs to get done, and I'm going to take care of things, and it's my house, and, you know, right. They're probably not even thinking about it. They probably don't even feel guilty about it.
You're talking about the abusive...
Yes, the abusive spouse, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're probably not thinking about it. And I see this in people all the time when they go, really? They think that's domestic violence, you know, punching a wall or throwing something across a room or, you know, not letting somebody out of a room or holding them down or something like that. That's not going to leave a mark. It's not going to send anybody to the hospital, but it's still violence and intimidation. I mean, it's every bit as violent as slapping someone. And I've had cases where husbands are, you know, doing a lot worse than that, throwing their wives literally out the door at night, you know, kicking them to the curb, and they're walking down the street barefoot without a cell phone, and nothing happens.
So Jill, I don't know if you could feel comfortable talking about this, but whatever happened to your friend?
Well, from where my friendship with her sort of ended up, because this was all kind of happening when I was kind of coming out and going through all my own life stuff. But I helped her move out of the house that they were in and helped her and her 3 kids move into a new home in another city. I also went with her to court when she went through the divorce and was able to present a bunch of information to the judge about the abuse and about the different things that he had done to them and a bunch of stuff from his history and from past marriages, some past marriages that she didn't even know came out. This guy was really a narcissist to the 10th degree. I mean, he had quite a history. So where I left her was in her new home with her kids and with him not knowing where they were and the court. I don't know what the courts decided to do with him. I don't know if he served any time or paid any penalties or just went on with his life. I don't know. And where she is today, I don't know.
So he, you cut out a little bit there, but he had been married previously to this marriage, and
he had been married previously 3 times. Three. She knew of 1 time.
Wow!
Oh. Whoa!
Yeah, it was amazing. One of his
that's a red flag.
Ex-wives, he had burned down a trailer that they lived in. He had burned it down with her in it.
Oh my gosh!
Tried to kill her. She didn't die, but he had attempted to kill her in this fire. And he saved these things in like locked filing cabinets, and he saved documentation of so much, just so much stuff that was very incriminating against him that all kind of
that's
came
really
out.
That's really scary.
It was intense.
I mean, if he's saving trophies, that's troubling.
That's like Voldemort.
Yeah, he was beyond. He was like beyond Dexter. Being helped by
like Horcruxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Domestic violence Horcrux.
Oh, he was not going to be helped by an LDS social services therapist. That's for sure.
Yeah. I don't know if this is probably shifting gears too much, but I really love the imagery at the end of the idea of the only safe place in the temple for you was in the woman's dressing room, and I think exactly. have got to feel like that in churches all over the place, is not feeling a place that's their own, that they can truly be safe. You know, Louis C.K. has a great line about, and this is, I guess this is kind of related to some of the things that have been going around on the kind of this idea of yes, every woman hashtag that's been going around. But Louis C.K. talks about how brave you women are, not you, Jill, because you've been shown the sense to abandon the male race as it pertains to intimate
partners. I'm not a man hater. I love women. Man. Just not
no. Vague. I'm not. But to say that
you're talking about the skit where it's amazing that they go out for a night with a guy because, like, statistically, that's the most terrible decision that they'll ever make. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's it. That's his bit. Going on a date, getting to here. I'm going to go out with you and get in this car alone with you. And
but it
highlights this point that there are places that women maybe rightfully would only feel safe around other women, or at least a place that would be safe for them. And that doesn't exist in the Mormon church because they don't have a woman to go to. It has to be another man. And I think that's a real problem.
So one aspect, yeah, and I do agree with that, Matt. One thing that I wanted to bring up from your essay, Jill, is about that question when the stake president asked you who's the head of your household. That just seemed like such a bizarre question to ask.
So weird.
Like, what was the context when he was like asking that question? I was trying to wrap my head around like the sentences that went before and after, but I can't even wrap my head around it.
I think he was trying to prove the point that my temple recommend worthiness or unworthiness was based on the fact that I didn't honor the priesthood and that I didn't believe in the main tenets of the gospel, which would be honoring the priesthood or allowing my husband to be the head of the household. So I think his question was meant to prove that.
He was baiting you.
He was baiting me, yeah. I mean, and had he asked my husband the same question, he'd have gotten the same answer.
Right. Well, I'm pretty sure there are several general authorities that have said, like, yes, the man is the head, whatever, but, like, parents co-parent equally and make decisions together. And it seems like you said exactly, you know, what several general authority have said, which doesn't make an, it just seems such a manipulative and weird question. I've never heard someone say that. Like, when I heard that, I was like, that is the strangest, most manipulative question I've ever heard in an interview.
Well, but this was what, like 20, you're talking like 20, 25 years ago that this happened, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean,
it was,
I think,
and it was several interviews in, so it wasn't your basic interview question.
Right.
We had already had a lot of talks by this point.
Yeah.
Did he know that you were questioning your sexual orientation?
No, because that would have been way too easy for him.
Right.
No, he didn't know that at the time.
So he wasn't like picking up anything with his power of discerning gaydar thing that he had.
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
He was getting the vibes. He just didn't know what they meant.
Right.
I have a question. So I was just amazed that you went back that many times. Did you set up these interviews? Did he set up the follow-up interviews? Like, that is just some amazing stamina. I think if I was rejected once, I would run away crying. Like,
I don't know if I was a glutton for punishment. I know I wanted my temple recommend, and I also became just very defiant.
Yeah.
I knew I had to win this battle, and it became a battle between me and that stake president. I had the support of my bishop. I had the support of
Marion D. Hanks.
I had the support of my husband. I just, this stake president was just being a narcissistic idiot, and I think I just needed to win the battle.
Yeah. Right. Well, it highlights an issue that I thought was interesting.
Well, I have it in my nature. My nature is to, if someone hurts me or if someone is hurting me, my response to them is to show them they're not hurting me by standing up to them, even if that hurts me more. I know, that's just kind of what I do.
No, it makes sense. It's, you know, you want to have control over the situation. You don't want them to control the situation. I think
you're
that
not
going to
give
sense.
Them the satisfaction.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I just couldn't believe. Oh, go ahead, Matt.
No, it highlighted this idea of there really is no person you can appeal to if your state president just says this is how it is. I mean, you had a letter from what's his name, Marion D. Hanks, which that should have carried some authority, I would think, with this guy, but even that didn't. And so if somebody is in a stake or in a ward that has one hard line bishop or state president, they're done. And yep. and it's that's just what a horrible just be someone to be trapped in that situation without anyone else really to go to.
Exactly.
Well, I mean,
and it was ironic too that when I finally did get my recommend, it was like, this is just stupid. I don't even want this anymore.
Yeah, so, I think it's textbook unrighteous dominion. I love that term, exactly. Unrighteous dominion.
Right, because there is righteous dominion.
Right,
you can dominate.
Right,
you can dominate righteous.
This is the unrighteous kind of dominion.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. It's the unrighteous
kind
domination.
When you disagree with it. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So yeah. I have a couple follow-up questions. One of them, how much of your leaving the church, your unhappiness with the church have to do with like your state president and your direct ward leaders? And how much do you think had to do with you know, coming out of the closet, dealing with, you know, the homophobia and things like that, or other issues? How much of it had to do with your direct leaders, do you think?
I think my leaving the church came from 10 years of questioning, and finally, after 10 years of questioning things historically and just things that didn't make sense in the church to me, and just dealing with the dissonance over and over and over again, finally I couldn't minimize that dissonance anymore. And then all these experiences started happening to validate my discontent with the church, these experiences with the stake president and on and on. And then I came out. I was already a feminist. I was already a so-called intellectual, and the only thing that was left was to be a homosexual. Yeah. So I don't know, maybe that's what drove me to it. Anyway, that was my last straw, was listening to Boyd K. Packer in a regional conference say that the three greatest enemies of the church were feminists, so-called intellectuals, and homosexuals, because I thought,
check.
Strike three. I'm out of here. Yeah, I just went home from that conference, took off my garments, and never went back.
So did you enjoy going to the temple before this experience with your state president? Was it a place of peace and solitude for you?
Yeah, I would say so, because I started going to the temple at 21 because I went on a mission. And when I returned from my mission, I didn't get married till I was 26, so there was 5 years there of just on my own without a patriarchal leader in my life. I was just going to the temple on a regular basis by myself and with other friends, and just really getting a lot out of it, I thought. So it was kind of a place of solitude and a place of comfort for me. So yeah, to have that recommend taken away was kind of, it was kind of difficult at the time.
What were the types of things, Jill, that you would get out of going to the temple? Like, did you have the kind of experience where you say, yeah, I learned something new every time? Was it that sort of thing, or was it just the feeling of being outside of the world and you're in this little bubble in the celestial room kind of thing? Or what was that appeal to you?
I think I must have learned things through osmosis, because to be honest, I fell asleep almost every time I went to the temple as soon as the lights went down. Well, but
that's what they told Adam to do.
Exactly.
Not Eve.
Close your eyes. Okay.
Yeah.
And I had it down really well, when to stand up, when to, I was like, you know, Did any of you ever, like, race other people to see if you could get your clothes on?
Yeah,
and all your,
yeah.
And be more efficient at it than anybody else and be the first one to sit down and put your slippers back on?
Uh-huh.
That was just kind of the thing. I think
I used
my
to do it with my eyes closed.
Exactly. My moments of temple sacredness came in the celestial room afterwards, I think, in meditation and in talking with the people that I went to the temple with and just learning and talking about, I guess at the time, deeper doctrine. So there was learning.
I wonder, this is totally, like, not statistically possible to figure out, but I wonder how many people who have left the church who had good experiences in the temple. Because most of the people that I talk about, that I talk to or hear, you know, had bad experiences in the temple, were freaked out, you know, it felt culty, it was uncomfortable, they had no idea what was going on, and that's almost, you know, the starting of them leaving, but that doesn't seem to be the case with you.
No, it wasn't. I had many years of temple attendance before that. It became weird afterwards from another perspective. Mm-hmm. As I look at it now, yeah, that's really weird.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So for you, Jill, was it hard to kind of transition away? I mean, did you feel like a sense of loss when the temple stopped being meaningful the way it was in the past?
Yeah, what the temple and the church in general, when I first left the church, I felt like I had the tether had been cut and I just flew like zero gravity, you know, just I had nothing to hold me, nothing to connect to. Being connected to that God outside of myself all of my life and having such a special relationship with the Savior and with God, and then not having that at all. I had nothing, and I really felt alone until I was able to connect inside of myself. And that was a whole process, and just kind of to learn my own value without God, without Jesus, without the church, that I had value as an individual, and then connecting with that has just been a whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And the temple played a big part of that, you know, because I guess my temple worthiness and my temple attendance and my temple experiences put me on a higher level somehow.
Would you call that spirituality?
Yeah, and put me on a higher level of spirituality.
And so, could you explain that a little bit more, like how you replaced that and what you replaced it with? Is it something that you would still consider spirituality, or is it something different?
Well, I went through the whole. I immediately went to another church. It was a new thought church called the Living Enrichment Center with a lot of metaphysical teachings and kind of totally opposite of Mormonism, but just as extreme. Mm. So I kind of, the pendulum kind of swung clear to the other side, and I really connected and became enmeshed with that church. Mm-hmm. But they did help me know that what was really important was inside of me, not outside of me. So it did me a lot of good in a lot of ways. But then I realized I had just as dysfunctional a relationship with that church as I had with the Mormon church. So after 7 years, I left that church. And now I've just kind of left religion altogether and am more or less an atheist now. I know you guys had a discussion about that, and I did another test on that too. Can't remember where I landed on that, but more or less just an atheist.
Like with the dualism and materialism discussion?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, that got complicated for me, but I'm to the point where I was, okay, there's not a God. That makes no sense to me. It's totally ridiculous. But you know what? If there is, it's okay. It doesn't matter, because I'm a good person. I'm not going to live my life differently whether there's a God or not a God. You know, I'm just going to let the mystery be, so to speak.
Right.
But yeah, more, there's no God. I mean, that just seems ridiculous.
Yeah, well, that's
That's interesting. I mean, you say like the pendulum swung the other way, but I can totally see where that would be coming from, though, because it's really, it seems like it's, Mormonism's not really about an internalized sense of self-worth. It's not really, I mean, that doesn't really seem like that's something, a high priority for it. Everything is, right. Everything is mediated. Yeah, right, right. And your essay kind of teased that and brought that up a lot, is, you know, you are waiting to get your recommend. You're waiting on this guy to give you this, to give you permission to go into this temple so that you could do a ritual so that you could be with God. You know, like everything's mediated. And there's no kind of internal sense of self-worth.
So I
like kind of
want to challenge that, Jake.
Go ahead.
Well, like you're taught from the time of primary that you're a child of God, and you know you start hearing things that you're part of the chosen generation. You were so so righteous and so valiant in the pre-existence that you were able to be born into a Mormon family that had the gospel, and so. Like I get that there are things that are mediated experiences, but I think there's also like a sense of many are called, few are chosen, elitist stuff that does give a sense of self-worth just because of who you are as a noble spirit.
Well, that's
of
true,
God.
Just relative to Mormonism.
It's still all about Mormonism, and it's still all about God that lives in heaven, which is outside of yourself.
Well, and all of the most important experiences after, you know, primary, you know, I think you're right through primary. It is all about your personal, God loves you, pray to God, he'll help you. But then after that, you know, to get baptized, you have to have an interview. Someone else has to deem you worthy. You have to, you know, in order to be baptized, someone, a priesthood has to, you know, put you in the water. When you go to the temple, you have to go through two men, which I never understood why you needed to go through a bishop and a state president. Like, it's always mediated through someone else who decides whether you're worthy enough to be close to God and to have those blessings.
Yeah.
And even the what you were just saying, you know, in primary you learn to pray to God, God outside yourself. You learn to seek answers from God, God outside yourself.
Yeah. I guess what I was thinking that it's like in Erica's case where there is that mediation between you and God as opposed to like a direct connection between you and
right.
God. That's where I was kind of pushing back on what I thought Jake was saying. But if you're talking about not even an outside God and it's just all about you, I mean, you're right. There isn't anything in Mormonism that says you're good just because of who you are. It's
right.
You're good because of you kept the first estate. You know, you're
right.
You're because of obedience, even before you were born. Obedience is what makes you good.
Right. And I'd like to just interject that I am of the most valiant generation.
Oh. Yeah, right.
Just like all the other ones before and after it.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Right. I remember the first time I heard somebody tell my children that they were part of the most valiant generation. I was like, what?
What about me? Yeah, I didn't even think about that. They got like... This is they're now starting on like the third, fourth generation telling them that.
Oh, you think
exactly.
It's just third or fourth?
I don't know.
It was
probably.
Like in Joseph Smith's day, Jesus was going to live with them in the city that they were building. They thought they were going to see him in like 5 years. They were the special chosen generation. Anyway, it's been part of the Mormon narrative from the very beginning.
Oh, yeah. You got a point. I don't know. I kind of want to push back a little bit on what Glenn was saying. I know this is backtracking and whatever. Maybe it's totally useless, in which case we can cut it out. But I feel like even when you are told that you're a super special child of God and you're so in, you know, you're part of the chosen generation, it's all relative to you're special because you're a Mormon,
right?
You know, and like it's defined. Your specialness is defined by your relationship to the church.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I still think in that sense, it's still, mediated. It's not, there's no kind of internal sense of self-worth. It's all relative to your relationship to Mormonism.
So when you lose that relationship, you lose your specialness and that's what you have to get back.
Right. All you are is a fallen elect now.
Yeah.
Right. The elite led astray.
Yeah. That's very unfortunate. It's a very unfortunate part of the Mormon church. It's when someone leaves the church, it's not like, well, God still loves them. It's like, well, we're just waiting for them to get their testimony so God can love them again. It's just like, oh, come on.
They got love on layaway.
They've got love on layaway.
See, I never, I don't think that the attitude is that God doesn't love them, but that they don't love God. That how unfortunate is that? That, you know, God still loves them and his hand is outstretched still, but they're not taking it. They're rejecting it. And
yeah, I can see that too. One of my favorite lines was when at the beginning, when Jill, when you said when church stopped being uplifting and it started being draining or something like that. Uh-huh. It was like, I don't know, it really resonated, because there are weeks when church can be uplifting, but overwhelmingly it's more draining. Like I leave sweaty, or I leave like stressed out and with a tension headache.
Are you still going, Erica?
Like once a month.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't given up the ghost quite yet. But, yeah, I don't know. It's sad. I don't know what makes that shift, but it's annoying.
Yeah. It was difficult. I mean, I know it was myself, my own thinking it was all about me, I guess, but you walk through the hallways or you're sitting in Relief Society or Sunday school thinking that everybody must think you're a horrible person and everybody's questioning your sexuality or everyone is feeling sorry for you, even though nobody gives a shit really about you at all. But yeah, I just feel, and then you listen to the lessons and nothing is resonating. Nothing is true anymore. It's, you take issue with almost everything that's said. That's how it kind of became for me. It was like a big human rights thing every week when I felt like I had to defend all humankind against every Relief Society lesson or every sacrament being talk. Because they were just so judgmental and just so small.
Right. It's always the Mormons against the world, and the world is just a smoldering pot of wickedness.
One week I went to Relief Society. This was after I came out to myself, but I hadn't come out to many people in the ward, and I was still under the illusion that I could stay married and stay active in the Mormon church and raise my children. I was in a Relief Society meeting, and one sister stood up. I don't know what the lesson was on, but she stood up and said, I would just never have a homosexual in my home for dinner or anything. And I just thought, oh, that's just awful. And so I went up to her afterwards and invited myself to dinner. And she actually said, sure, why don't you and your family come to dinner next week? So she had a homosexual in her home the very next week.
You showed her.
I showed her.
Yeah, but she didn't know, so it didn't count.
She did not know.
Yeah.
That's so perfect.
With your last bite of dessert, you should have smiled at her and said, guess what?
I should just write her a note right now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, she's our next listener essay. Baby, come back. Any kind of fool could see there was something in everything about you. Baby, come back. Hi, this is Matthew Vernon, recording from Whitingham, Vermont, the birthplace of Brigham Young, a man of superb equipment. Seriously, just Google his birthplace marker and you can see for yourself. Or you can comment on this episode on the website infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Baby, come back.
I'm glad. Thank you. Jake, before we get off, we were talking about for Jill, you know, what she replaced that void with, and I know for you, one of the things that you replaced it with was Walter White and Breaking Bad, and you actually had a pretty cool experience this last week. Do you want to bear your testimony about what happened?
Yes, I want to bear my testimony.
Of the truth.
I know that Bryan Cranston is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we went on a trip to New York before I started my new job full time, and we went to a play that he's doing where he's depicting LBJ, and so
It's called All the Way.
Right, it's called All the Way. It's playing on Broadway. Anyway, so we got tickets for it, and we planned on afterwards sticking around and trying to meet him. And so we, I, you know, shaved my head and my face into a goatee, and I look a lot like Walter White, and I have like little glasses like he does and stuff.
You
and
bet
a little,
you wore the hat.
Yeah.
The pork
pie hat. I even had the pork pie hat. So I looked exactly like, I mean, I looked just like Heisenberg.
Right, right.
and yeah, and afterward, so after the play, we were like all huddled around the stage door because we thought maybe we'll get a glimpse of him, you know, like as he gets into a car and like in my fantasy, like he makes eye contact with me and winks or something and then gets in the car. And so like I had this idea in my head and we're huddled around the stage door anyway, but he actually comes out of the doors to the theater, the main entrance to the theater. And he stands there and everybody that waited for him, he signed their playbill, chatted with them, took a picture. Like every single person. This was like a Tuesday.
Starting at the back of the line.
Too. Yeah. Yeah. So like this was like a Tuesday evening performance. I mean, it wasn't like a huge headliner or anything. But anyway, he was incredibly gracious and I got a picture with him. So that was 1,000 times more fulfilling than my mission. Anyway. So, boom.
High praise from Jake.
Yes, high praise from Jake.
Hey there. Hey, you know what we're out of? You know, fresh plum out of? We've run out of listener outros. I mean, it was great. We had about 8 of you that just sent things in right off the bat, and we've used them and kind of recycled some of them, but there's more than 8 of you listening to this, so how about going to our website, infantsonthrones.com, looking at the contact tab up at the top right-hand corner of the page. There's instructions, there's a little script, there's an email address you can record and send it to us, and we'll use it. Please, pretty please, is there anything that I can do, anything that I can give you to incentivize you to do this? Maybe a little more President Monson backing player, huh? Huh? And I just can't
live. Baby, come back, come back, come back. Any kind of fool could truly see. There was something in everything about you. Baby, come back. You could blame it all on me. I was wrong. I was wrong. Baby, baby. Come back. Come back. I was wrong.
Come on, please. Please. Help us out. Help us out.
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.